Welcome to Beauty and the Brain with your hosts, Dr. Chris Crowley and nurse practitioner Jerry Drinkard. Get ready to dive into the latest in revolutionary treatments, cutting-edge devices, and wellness secrets. Whether you're a consumer or provider, we're here to empower you at the forefront of beauty and aesthetics.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Beauty and the Brain, the podcast where we discuss all things aesthetics. I'm your co-host, Dr. Chris Crowley.
And I'm Jerry Drinkard, family nurse practitioner. Together, Chris and I own Skin and Tonic, Med Spa that's located in Pace, Florida. And this week, we're continuing our episode from last week, actually. And so we're going to rejoin with Dr. Charles Runnels.
Yeah, we've known Charles for many years, almost two decades now, and really just an amazing individual, an amazing physician, a wealth of knowledge. And we're going to get to dive a little bit deeper into some of his procedures today, things that we've been doing for a while, talking about P shots, O shots, vampire face lifts, Clitox.
Kind of fun fact about Dr. Runnels, he was the first person to put a Botox needle in my face, trying to correct asymmetry on my eye, and he's the first person to put a needle in my penis.
Yeah, he was the first. Okay, let's jump right into this episode and learn more from Dr. Charles Runnels.
Okay, but you know what I would like to do? Let's save it to the end so your people will hang on and listen to it. Ask me something else.
All right. Well, we'll save it the best question ever.
By the way, I was taught this question by probably one of the smartest people I ever knew. He was a psychiatrist from the Bronx. He taught me in medical school. And he had a, that man was so freaking smart. He could look at you across the room, and I'm not exaggerating. He'd probably know 16 things about your mother's mother from watching you across the room. And he's the one that taught me this sex question to ask. So anyway, he was a cussing Bronx Jew, and I loved the shit out of him. He'd have me over to his house because we loved each other. He found out I lived out of my car for years, so that made me at least not boring to a very bright mind about why I did that and what happened. So we loved each other. So I'll tell you his question, but let's save it to the end since maybe that'll make people hang on.
Well, I want to talk just a little bit about something that I think will hit be interesting to a lot of our listeners. So providers who are interested in learning about this, as well as patients who are curious about these procedures and what they entail. So I want to talk a little bit about what the CMA looks like, what the training looks like, what people go through to learn this procedure so that patients or clients who are considering this understand when they search for a verified provider what they're getting. That this is not just something that people are doing willy-nilly and going down and getting the same sort of machine that we use at the hospital and injecting things that are not improved into their bodies. There actually is a lot of science behind this. I know we took classes from you, Jerry and I, and it was one of the first things that we incorporated in our office here when we moved back from Chicago. And we've been in the group for a long time. And when we went back to be instructors, I love this story a lot. I don't know if you remember it, Charles. I know you teach a lot of people. But when we come back to do our instructor coach training with you, I signed Jerry up to be the model and I didn't tell him. And your office called me.
You didn't know you were going to be at NECA that day, did you?
I had no idea.
Let me ask you, what do you think he was the most stressed about? We walked in and it had his name on the big white paper and it said Jerry, trifecta. And what do you think he was the most nervous about?
Probably the face more than the penis. I don't know. What was it?
No, his hair.
I didn't want to have my head injected.
He didn't want to have his head injected. He didn't care about his penis being injected. He's like, sure, inject away.
But then when we got there. Yeah, you got me on that one. I would not have guessed the hair.
Yeah, and then when we got there, Dr. Rachel, she was from the doctor show. She was there training with you that day. And so Dr. Rachel, I had my phone while we were doing, I was the model, and I asked her, I said, would you mind just to hold my penis up? Because no one quite as famous as you has ever held it before.
Can I get a photo?
So that was our intro into training to be instructors, you guys, but we have learned so much over the years. And so from your standpoint, what is it like to see so many thousands of people now using your technique, using your method to really perfect this so the patients do have safe results and amazing outcomes?
Yeah, like I said, I've become more of a curator because, for example, the way that we make the clitoris numb when we do the O shot. I learned that from two other doctors. One was my wife, one was Sophia Lubin out of New York City. that you guys have taught me things about how you're doing your business. And by the way, while I'm on the subject, anybody that's watching this, we do have people in 50 something countries. I've taught thousands of doctors, New Delhi, New Zealand, Australia, London, Spain, South Africa, all over, Uganda. And you guys are top tier, you know? And so it's beautiful that we've known each other so long, but while it's on my mind, I just want to brag on the two of you. Smart, you do it right, personable, you know the science. And then to expand on that, to answer your question, we have a lot of amazing people in our group. We have professors from Duke, we have urologists, gynecologists, urogynecologists, plastic surgeons, radiologists, interventional radiologists, physiatrists, and primary care, internists and family practitioners and anesthesia and pain doctors. And when we all getting together online once a week and in small groups frequently, when you're teaching classes, when I'm teaching, I'm learning too. And I've been teaching almost every month now for 15 years. When we're teaching and exchanging ideas, what's happening, what the group involves is this collective mastermind, if you want to call it that. And then anyone who's certified by us and licensed by us has either been through a hands-on class with someone who has, all of our teachers have had hands-on training with me. So there's not an A tells B and B tells C, and then you don't know what E and F are doing. It's we all know what we're teaching. Or if they're qualified and have the right license, for example, someone who's already skilled with fillers can watch the videos and take an online test and click and agree to following the protocols and get certified to do a vampire facelift. But they just can't. We have full-time staff. I have 5 full-time people that do nothing but see over our group. And they're going to call the person, check their license, check their qualifications, check their test to make sure they passed it. And then they get on the directory. So that's how the quality of care happens. Can I go back to the orgasm day and the sex for just a minute?
Yes. I thought we started there. We should have went with that.
Well, I did give my staff off for orgasm day. If you get off for Columbus and, I don't know, 16 other bank holidays, you get to get off for orgasm day, pun intended. And so I give them the day off paid and encourage them to spend it in a fun way. Now, trying to think of a kind way to say this. I'll state a fact. There was a paper that came out, a research paper that came out, the Journal of Sexual Medicine, High Impact Journal, where 2 years ago, they went to the 7 medical schools in Chicago, and they looked to see how many of them were teaching the anatomy of the clitoris and how many of them were teaching a physician in a gynecology residency how to do a history and a physical exam on a woman with sexual problems. How many do you think passed the test? 1. 6 of the 7 were not teaching the clitoral anatomy. 6 of the 7 had no part of their program where they were teaching how to ask questions and make a plan with a physical exam of a woman with sexual problems. 6 of the 7. So I'm at a family gathering and I see a distant relative recently who's faculty at a medical school, I won't say which one, where he teaches gynecologists. And I tell him about my procedure and I said, you know, we have some research dollars. That's the other thing that our group does. We pay for research. And I wonder if you think you would want to look at some of the protocols that we'd like to examine and help us with the research with your teaching facility, and I know you do research. He said, I'm not interested, and the residents won't be interested either. And I said, well, you do realize 40% of your patients have sexual problems. He said, yeah, but we're too busy. We have to think about the life and death stuff with the baby. We don't want to talk about sex. And so not only are they not teaching it, that is an example. And I thought, oh, there's reality. The reality is, and you really blame them. Okay, yeah, you got 2 people that could die on your hands. Do you want to take away from your need to document that you've done X number of C-sections to go study how to talk with a woman about orgasm? But the reality is most gynecologists do not want to do that. I've had gynecologists tell me, I wish you would rename it because I know it works for incontinence, but I don't want to call it an O shot because I don't want to talk to women about sex. A gynecologist. I'll tell you why I think this happens and why you guys are good at your job other than being bright physicians. One reason you're good at your job, think about this. If you tell me you have a sore throat, my personal life will no way involve our conversation. It won't be involved. But if you tell me you have a sex problem, man or woman, and I open up the conversation, if I'm not comfortable with my own sexuality, I will be worried about where the conversation is going to go and therefore avoid the conversation. In other words, in order to be an excellent sex doctor, you have to be comfortable with your sexuality and you have to celebrate sexuality in all the ways that people practice sex. And most doctors cannot do that. If you read the ad for coming to work for me, it says something like, if you are not willing to take out the trash with a smile and not able to have a conversation with someone with a PhD or an MD, don't apply. If you're not willing to get naked in public in a class with people watching me inject every part of your body, don't apply. If you are not only tolerant, but celebratory of all the ways that grown people make love legally, as long as not involving children and animals, don't apply. And you know what? I get the most amazing applicants, and they fit with my crew, and we have fun, and we help people. But if you think about it, that would be the exact same job requirement for a doctor that's going to be a sex doctor, and most people could not apply. Most of your colleagues could not apply. And so it's important what we do. It's needed, and I feel like I'm the most lucky person I know to be able to talk with brilliant, brave people like the two of you who are literally changing medicine in spite of the enemies that are lurking.
I have a subject that a lot of people don't know how to talk about. I think oftentimes people probably Google us or look at our website and they come in for Botox, but really what they're here for is something to do with sexual health. They just don't know how to approach it. And so in my office, I have a giant disco penis sitting on the shelf. I never mention it, but I can't tell you how many times it's opened a conversation for sexual health because they'll say, is that a penis? And I'm like, yeah. So we do some sexual health stuff. And then I go into it and I tell them all, like, sex is taboo until you talk about it. And then sex is sex. It's part of your overall health. And I think a lot of people don't understand that because they've never had anybody talk to them about it. And especially in the area that we live in. I mean, we're still Bible Belt here. And so it's one of those things that you've probably made it easier for us because anybody that goes to your classes, the class may start out like slightly uptight. And after listening to you talk for about 30 minutes, everybody in that class is open. And I hope that people leave there able to talk about things. One of your classes I was in, you talked about going to a masturbation seminar. I've never even heard of that. And
that's why you're good at what you do, because it does take bravery and it takes being comfortable with your own sexuality. And I didn't know there was such thing as a disco penis. Now I want to know where to.
Yes, Sierra's going to bring it. I will show you before we get off thing, but it is a giant sparkle penis that he has sitting in his office for everybody to see and talk about.
Well, the reason that I happen to be at the right place at the right time because I heard some lectures that made me interested in tailor making female hormones back now 26 years ago in 2000. And started doing that. But as women came in and I made it safe for them to talk, really more than the men, they would often break down and cry and sob because they were afraid to talk with their husband, afraid of hurting or offending the husband. They couldn't tell their friends. It's like a psychological problem. You know, if you have sore throat or if you got cancer, you tell people about it. But if you got a sex problem, you don't. It's if you got schizophrenia, You don't put that on Facebook because it's a social stigma for having a psychological problem. And the same thing, there's a social stigma for having a sexual problem, and they know they're very unlikely to get kind counsel from friend, family, priest, rabbi, hardly anybody if they talk about it. So if you become the person they can talk with, they will often sob just out of relief that someone is listening to their story.
Well, the other thing that we found, I think a big part of what we do in this portion of our practice is communication and even helping couples communicate. Because it's amazing how many people will not talk with their own partner, their own spouse. But once we facilitate that conversation, and we're not therapists, we're not trying to be sex therapists, we're not trying to replace anyone's job, we open communication. But we've had guys here getting pee shots, and Jerry's been in one room doing a pee shot while I'm sitting out in the lobby talking to his wife, who we've known, and she's basically thinking he has erectile dysfunction, and the guy's back there saying, no, I have no trouble masturbating, I have no trouble with this, she's so dry it's uncomfortable. And I'm like, meanwhile, we should, but he doesn't want to tell her. He doesn't want to hurt her feelings. He doesn't want to say anything to her. She's probably been uncomfortable as well. So then we have to facilitate that communication that maybe we're not even down the right pathway here, because he didn't bother sharing that with us until the moment he was getting the actual procedure. And so a lot of that is communication between couples, between spouses. And I think in addition to the disco penis, one of the other biggest tools that we've had is your book, Activate the Female Orgasm System. So when we put that out, it's been an amazing tool that we've used for many years. And we teach all of our employees, our staff, our team members, that if somebody even touches it, looks at it, glances at it, to make it an easy conversation to say, just take it. And you taught us that. We don't ask questions. We don't dive into it. And then they can go back. They can read the book. They can look at more information on the website. But just seeing that and knowing that we're comfortable having that conversation oftentimes is enough to break down that barrier. But as you pointed out, we as providers have to be very comfortable with having those conversations. Otherwise, it will come through in our discussion, our consult with the patient. Jerry, do you have the penis there to show?
Yeah, let's wind up with two things. I'll show my penis and Charles can ask his question that he was holding out on.
There
how
you
about
go.
That?
You want to show the disco penis?
Yeah, and Jerry said he'll show his penis.
Yeah.
Dude, can you
I love it. But yeah, I like it.
Spinning on his desk for anybody to ask about. So when they come in, it definitely is a conversation starter when you're sitting there and they're like, is that a giant disco penis on your desk?
I love it. Yeah, that would definitely be a conversation starter. Yeah, I know we need to wind down some. Let me mention, I know you guys are doing this and thinking and talking about it, but we have, if you think about sexual problems, well, let's go back to your anesthesia days. If somebody had pain, you had pretty reliable ways of taking it away. As an internist, I used to tell people when I diagnosed them with cancer, because they have one of their worries is chronic pain, I would tell them, I promise you, I will always have more pain medicine than you have pain. Always. I may not be able to make this cancer go away, but you're not going to hurt. And you can do that with one medicine, one injection, one pill. You can think of six ways you can make that promise true. We don't have that equivalent in sexual medicine where there's a magic shot like an IV morphine and all the pain goes away. Here's a magic shot and your erection is going to be hard or your dyspareunia is going to go away. And so it often works out to be a combination of therapies taking into account a system analysis. So I would leave your people maybe with just a few ideas. One, think in terms of systems, just like you do with respiratory system, pulmonary system, and the gastrointestinal nervous system. There's 11 body systems. I would like to propose that God usually made things in 10 and 12, and there's a 12th system called the orgasm system. And if you go to orgasmcollege.com, you'll find a poster that you can download about the female orgasm system. I haven't done one for males yet, but it would be very similar. So think in terms of systems analysis, whether you're a lay person just trying to have better sex. What else can I do to have my lover have more pleasure? Let's think of everything here that's on this picture and try to optimize all of it, just like you would with an athlete. And second is that we do have some new ideas regarding botulinum toxin and its ability to change the autonomic nervous system, We have 5 double-blind placebo-controlled studies backing up the idea behind our priapus toxin and using botulinum toxin in the corpus cavernosum to then cause vasodilatation by relaxation of smooth muscle of the arterial blood flow and possibly modulation of the autonomic nervous system, decreasing sympathetic, increasing parasympathetic, which is what causes an erection. And we've got those studies, and it can be added to the P-shot. The other thing that is that we've only done one study yet. My wife and I, as a gynecologist, published a study about a similar idea. We call it clitoxin, where we mix botulinum toxin with PRP when we do the O-shot. And that blew flibanserin and bromelanotide out of the water. Like on the average, flibanserin boosts female sexual function index by about 5. Bromelanotide bumps it by about 4. And when you combine the O-shot with botulinum toxin, it bumped female sexual function index over 10. We could have used flibanserin as our freaking placebo and showed benefit. And so it's not, it doesn't mean that it has to be done every time there's an O-shot, but in those original studies with priapus toxin, they using botulinum toxin corpus cavernosum, they had men with spinal cord injuries and such, people I would never treated. So we've expanded the possibilities. And so those are two new ideas I know you guys are exploring and your patients want to know about. And then if we're coming to the end, I can give you the best sex question ever.
Yeah, I want to hear the best sex question ever.
I'm ready.
We're ready for it. We're braced for it.
Okay. So he said, ask people. Now, I understood it on a superficial level. And after I turned 40, I understood it on a deeper level. I'm going to tell you superficial, and then I'm going to tell you deep. And I'm about to say something I don't think I've ever said that was recorded. But the question I have talked about before, you ask the person, what is the very first sexual fantasy they can remember? It tells you your sexual orientation. So if people wonder, am I oriented, what's my favorite flavor of genitalia? That question helps you get to it. And I left it at that. But then I found, no. It goes way deeper than that. Like the first sexual fantasy I can remember, I won't tell her name, it was third grade is the first sexual fantasy I can remember. And I remember imagining tying the girl to the wall. Not doing anything to her, not hurting her, but I wanted to control her. Didn't even know what a vagina looked like. And now, it's not just about the flavor genitalia, it's about what flavor is your orientation. I think we should know what flavor genitalia. Are you dominant? Are you submissive? Are you kind? Are you mean? Are you, there's all these other facets, just like your disco penis. I think our sexuality has as many facets as that disco penis does. And that gets you to the basis of it. So I think when people are struggling with their sexuality, if they will even to themselves remember that first fantasy, it will tell them many things about themselves. For women, I like to ask them, what did you used to have your Barbie dolls do? With either another Barbie or G.I. Joe, what were those dolls doing? Because that gives me a good idea about what you're going to like tonight after dinner. That's my favorite sex question. I recommend you use it occasionally with each other, with your patients, with people who have a wanting to explore who they are at greater depth. I think we were made the way we were made. I think that I probably came out of the womb wanting to control women. But not for their demise, but in a way that brings them pleasure. And I don't think that's going to change. I'll be that way when I'm 95. I was that way in the third grade. So this whole bullshit about trying to therapy somebody out of what's in their genes is bullshit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we both agree with you.
I think it also makes people comfortable with who they are. I was made this way. Yay. Thank you very much. The rest of the world can fuck off if you don't like it, because God made me this way. And so, yeah, just like others might be uncomfortable with what flavor genitalia they like, a straight man can be uncomfortable that his flavor is he likes to control women. But usually if they're controlled by me, they want more of it because their life becomes pretty spectacular. And so that can be as difficult to embrace if it has stigma associated with it, right? So I recommend people ask the question, embrace your weirdness as being not weird, but the way God made you, tell the rest of the world to fuck off.
Yeah. And I think that's the interesting thing that you kind of buried in there a little bit about how it changed after you got to be hit 40. I think the age is a little different for all of us, but at some point you are empowered enough that you don't care what other people think, right? That's where I am now. So I'll be 51 tomorrow. But at some point you get to where it's like, okay, I do embrace it. And things that I thought were unacceptable or weird, it's me. And I don't have to justify that to people around me. Whereas, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, maybe I would have looked at it a lot more superficially and thought, well, you know, I don't, that's not right to say that. I've been taught that this is not the way things should work. So let me hide it. I mean, Jerry and I have been an openly gay couple for many, many years. That was hard growing up in the South. But at some point you get more comfortable with that. But also, like you said, the nuances and the that are within that category. Because people think just because, you know, you're gay, all gay people are X. And it's like, nope, that's not true either. Like, we all have these things. And I think it's fascinating that you share yours and you embrace it. Whereas maybe when you're in your 30s, if you said, I like to control women, it would have been perceived very negatively. Now it's like, nope, that's me. It's who I am. I like to do this. But it actually makes them feel good.
The next level, the first level, he was suggesting I think he was suggesting more, but all I understood when he told me that question was this is a way to help people understand their sexual orientation and not struggle with it. But I just caught the superficial level. But then it took me 40 to understand there are many, many other levels to take that by going back to what was your first fantasies. And it truly is in our genetics. I don't think that's something that happened at all from what I was just, I mean, that's the way I was made. But the other last, maybe I'll leave one last thing, okay, is that there's a reason why every major religion talks about sex. And if you look in the depths of it, and I haven't practiced everything, but I was brought up Southern Baptist, sent my kids to a Catholic school. My dad practiced Judaism in a certain way. We ate kosher, and he always said the Jews are the smartest people ever. And I wound up finding out I'm like 10% Jew. I studied meditation with the last living disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. Roy Davis had a meditation place up in North Georgia where I started going to when I was 20s, and read the Gita and the Quran. And if you look at religions, there's always a place where sex is important. And I think it was meant to be not repressive, but to be a source of inspiration and a source of transmuting to a higher level. And when we do this right, when we're helping people with their sexuality, we're helping them with their spirituality. I highly recommend people pick up a book that came out a few years ago by the man who wrote Care of the Soul, Thomas More. He was a Catholic monk who went AWOL, but he wrote a book called, and you can get it on Audible, listen to it, called A Religion of One's Own. Or maybe it's A Religion of Your Own. Religion of One's Own, I think. But he talks about blending what's true for you and the great spiritual traditions into not casting aside religion, but making it part of everything you do, your work, your sexuality. And I think that's what the two of you do. People, I think, can be around you and know there's a spirituality about you that gives power to your healing. And so I would recommend people not just take it to an even deeper level. It's not even just about your pleasure and your family and your job. It's about your spirituality, and it's all there together if you're courageous enough to embrace your weirdness.
Well, Charles, Dr. Runnels, we appreciate so much you taking the time, more than you know. Literally, we have been so excited about this since you agreed to be on the podcast. If you guys are out there listening and you enjoyed this, then you can find more of Dr. Runnels. We're going to put links to the Cellular Medicine Association, his group. You can get education on P-shots, O-shot, vampire procedures, all the things he's talked about. And join and be part of the group, because he gives wonderful insight and advice weekly. There's a lot of learning, so lots more of his advice and knowledge out there. Again, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. It's our privilege to have you here.
It's been such a pleasure. We've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I always learn from you guys too, and always inspired. Keep doing the good work, and thank you for having me on your show.
Thanks everyone for tuning in for another episode of Beauty and the Brain. We look forward to seeing you all next week.
We'll see you soon.